Clerk will call the docket.
Stephen D. Rankin against the Commonwealth of Virginia, James O. Brockolette, Randall J. Lehman Jr., Nicole A. Malone, for the appellant, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Virginia B. Tyson, Senior Assistant Attorney General for the appellate.
You may proceed.
Good morning. Please, the court. My name is James Broccoletti from Norfolk. With me today is Mr. Randall Lehman and Ms. Nicole Belotin. Together, we represent the appellant in this matter, Stephen Rankin. The matter before the court is singular in terms of one issue and one assignment of error that the court has granted. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. I want to tell you ahead of time, you really do need to make sure that you spend some time talking about preservation issues as well.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Well, I think we'll address that right now, then, if the court brought that matter up. With respect to the Attorney General's position with respect to the assignment of error and the harmless error determination by the Court of Appeals, under Rule 517, the petition for appeal, in terms of the assignments of error 3, it says that an assignment of error and an appeal from the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court, which recites that the trial court erred and specifies the errors in the trial court, will be sufficient so long as the Court of Appeals ruled upon the specific merits of the alleged trial court error. And the error assigned in the court is identical to that assigned in the Court of Appeals. The error we assigned to this court is identical to the error that we assigned to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals did rule in its per curiam opinion that the statement itself, this was my second one, either was not relevant, was relevant to show the defendant's state of mind and or was evidence of another crime. So we believe that the assignment of error that we produced in this court is identical to the one produced in the Court of Appeals.
Well, I think that is not necessarily sufficient to address what the problem may be. If you have an error in the trial court and you cite it in the Court of Appeals and then you cite that error again in this court, that's sufficient. That's what that rule is all about.
Correct.
But if what you're alleging is an error that occurred at the Court of Appeals, that's a different matter altogether. And the Court of Appeals apparently found that it was the error in this particular case on the issue we're talking about was harmless error. And there doesn't appear to be an assignment of error that the Court of Appeals was wrong in finding that it was harmless error. Can you address that?
As the Attorney General points out in its brief under this court's decision from 2017, Commonwealth v. White, in the statutory scheme, this court is always obligated to determine whether an error was harmless. So therefore, this court always has the independent basis and independent duty and obligation.
But that's not the issue. The issue is whether the Court of Appeals erred in finding it was harmless.
Correct.
We can sua sponte determine a lot of things, but that doesn't determine the scope of the appellate assignment of error.
Well, with respect to the Court of Appeals on the merits determined that the statement, which is at issue, it's my second one, was admissible for various factors. We assigned error to that, to this particular court. The court also made a separate determination, but under that separate determination and under the White decision, it's our position and under the assignment of error under 5:1-3, that this court always has the obligation to make that determination. So we feel that the assignment of error being identical and the Court of Appeals ruling on the merits about the relevancy of that particular statement preserves the issue to this court.
And counsel, the second sentence of your assignment of error says this statement was unduly prejudicial to Mr. Rankin. Court of Appeals said it was harmless. Well, by saying it's unduly prejudicial, it goes right in the teeth of the Court of Appeals holding that it was harmless. How can it be harmless if it's unduly prejudicial? So it seems to me that that addresses the argument that there's no challenge to the harmlessness.
Yes, Your Honor, I'd agree with
the harm.
So your position is you actually did have an assignment of error that actually addressed the alternative position of the Court of Appeals that whatever error, if any, was harmless. That's your position?
The position is that the assignment of error that we raised to this court is broad enough and comprehensive enough to include both of the issues that the Court of Appeals...
Did any of your argument section address the harmless error standard, cite a single case on harmless error, or direct our attention to the harmless error ruling of the Court of Appeals?
It did it in the context of 2403, being that the probative value was outweighed by the prejudicial aspect
of it. That is not a harmless error. That's error versus non-error. 403A is an error analysis. It's not a harmless error analysis.
Well, I would suggest to the court that 403A encompasses a harmless error instruction because it determines whether or not there is sufficient prejudice to overcome any probative value that's associated with the introduction of the statement.
Okay.
So, if I could...
I think we understand your position. You need to get on to the substance of your case.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. With respect to the substance of the case, the issue, this is, don't go far, this is my second one, was... introduced by the Commonwealth during the course of the case, despite a ruling by the trial court prior to and a motion in limine that the 2011 shooting was not relevant, that it was too prejudicial, outweighed the probative value, and therefore was to be excluded. Yet inexplicably, and without any explanation whatsoever, the court said motion denied. So we don't know what the trial court was thinking at the time that the trial court denied that the second motion in limine to exclude that particular statement. So we look at to what was argued both before the trial court and then what was argued at the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals ruling itself. On page 155 of the joint appendix, the Commonwealth argued to the trial court, Your Honor, the problem the Commonwealth has is that the defense wants to ask the Commonwealth or ask the court to rule that the Commonwealth has to sanitize the evidence in the case. And then later on page 157, it goes further and talks about coaching witnesses and things of that nature. The Commonwealth, in its argument to the trial court, conceded that it was not evidence of another crime, but said that you can't ask us to sanitize the record. Well, that happens every day. We tell in Fifth Amendment cases a police officer not to describe a statement that was taken in violation of Miranda. We tell witnesses not to describe circumstances or issues with respect to prejudicial areas of their testimony. So the Commonwealth argued that aspect of the trial court. When you got to the Court of Appeals, then the Court of Appeals statement, which is again found on page 88 of the joint appendix, says the statement without more did not indicate appellant had shot and killed another person. What did it indicate? What was the purpose of introducing that statement? What was the relevancy of that statement? Even if it did, however, it came within the well-established exceptions to the rule against admitting evidence that the accused had committed other crimes.
May I interrupt you for a second,
Yes, sir.
Ms. Brecklady? But the objecting party has the burden of persuasion, right? The objecting party has to articulate the basis of the objection.
Correct.
It's not really necessary for the responding party to say anything. They can just sit there and say, not so. That would be sufficient, and we would impute to the trial judge any rational 401A or 403 401 or 403A analysis, right? Why is that not the case here?
Well, the proponent of the evidence has the burden of establishing the relevancy and the method for its admissibility. So in this particular case, the proponent at the trial court level was the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth argued you can't sanitize the evidence.
But my point is that is a locution. That's just a metaphorical way of saying something. It's really saying 401 it's relevant, and 403, it's not unduly prejudiced.
Right.
Why does there need to be any further articulation?
Well, because the reason I'm bringing it out and the reason I'm pointing out the other reasons and inconsistencies is that no one knows why this evidence was admissible.
Why don't we impute to the trial judge that the trial judge knew the law, followed the law, and then look at the record to see if there's evidence that would support his ruling?
And that the court can do that, and the point that I'm trying to make is there's no basis for introduction of this statement under the law. So whether you take the trial court's determination that, yes, we're trying to sanitize the evidence, or you impute to the trial court what the Court of Appeals found, that it comes within the well-established exceptions. Either way that you skin it, it's not admissible.
Okay, fair enough. Then why isn't it admissible on 401 and passes 403's filter on state of mind?
State of mind for what? State of mind to establish what? That the defendant, that there was a motive behind the defendant's killing? He was a police officer that went to a scene to arrest a shoplifting suspect, didn't know the person, had no contact, got into a fight, was disarmed, his taser was knocked out of him, the man started to lunge at him. How does his state of mind with respect to a prior shooting which occurred 4 years before, which was completely irrelevant, there was no nexus between the two of them, have any impact upon his state of mind at that time? And if the Court of Appeals talks about it being evidence of another crime, as does the Attorney General, what's the crime? What crime did he commit? What evidence is there that this was a bad act on his part, that it all falls within 404B? There's no evidence it's another crime, which is why it's taken completely out of context. It's completely out of context without any background that's given to the jury. The trial couldn't have expected us, to be able to introduce evidence about that 2011 shooting to explain that statement. That's not a burden that we can, well, number one, we have no burden to produce any evidence. But to introduce that statement to the jury creates confusion, creates prejudice, has them go back there and they're scratching their head. What does that statement mean? It's my second one. It's not evidence of another crime, and that's where the Court of Appeals was wrong in finding that. The other statement that the Court of Appeals made on page 88, as I indicated, was the statement didn't indicate that he shot and killed another person. What did it mean then? This is my second one. There just was a shooting. There's clearly a nexus between that statement and the event that had just occurred under the res justi, if you will. So it clearly was related to the fact that he had shot another person before.
You have 4 minutes, 43 seconds left. You may use your time any way you'd like.
And I was about to sit down.
All right.
Thank you.
You have 4 minutes, 36 remaining. Ms. Tyson, why don't we start right where he left off? If that statement was entered into evidence, surely the Commonwealth used it in their closing argument to a jury. What was the relevance that the Commonwealth cited for the introduction of that evidence?
Your Honor, first of all, I think it's very important to note that we don't know if the Commonwealth used that in its closing argument, because the closing argument was not transcribed and it's not before this court. But in response to the question, the relevance was to the state of mind. And whether that was articulated at the trial level by the Commonwealth or not, it does fall within that res justi. I know normally what we see as far as conduct or statements of a defendant following a crime may be something like flight from the scene or destruction of the evidence. That's not what we have in this case, but we have a statement. We have a statement that this is my second one. And it doesn't, to be relevant, does not have to prove what the state of mind is, but just needs to shed some light on that. And so in this case, the statement, which was not, oh, there was an accident, or my gun malfunctioned, or what have you, the statement was to the Walmart security officer, don't go far, this is my second one. So looking at the requirement under this court's decision in Profit, that the relevance standard is, does this shed some light on an issue?
What element of manslaughter did it shed light on? What legal element of the crime of manslaughter?
Your Honor, as far as manslaughter is concerned, this was voluntary manslaughter, so this was an intentional killing. I think it's important to remember at the time this evidence was introduced, self-defense had not been argued to the jury, and still on the table was first-degree murder and second-degree murder and such. So at the time this was introduced, the Commonwealth still bore the burden of proving intention, deliberation, and premeditation. And so going to the state of mind at that point in the trial, the Commonwealth was still introducing evidence to prove a case of first-degree murder. It didn't end up that way, but that's what was still before the jury at that time.
Okay, then what element of first-degree murder or second-degree murder or any lesser included offense was that statement logically relevant to?
It was logically relevant to actually a couple of things. One, the intent of the defendant in shooting. And secondly, even whether you call it prior bad acts or whatever you call it, the accident, the lack of accident or the lack of mistake, both of those things, again, this sheds some light on the
so
intent.
So the main inference is a sense of intentionality as opposed to mere accident.
Correct.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think it's important to consider a couple of practical things about this case as well. And I've already mentioned where we are in the trial when this evidence is introduced. There was a concern, and that was noted by the prosecutor in this case, about redaction of the taser and that evidence was being played for the jury, and to take something out of the tape was a concern. I think it's important that the court instructed the jury not to speculate or engage in guesswork. This is at page 273 of the appendix. It's important to note that no juror who gave an indication during voir dire of knowing about the past of this defendant or knowing about the prior shooting actually deliberated, which is why we attach the jury strike sheet as an addendum to our brief. So the jury is instructed, don't speculate, don't engage in guesswork. What the jury hears is, this is my second one. And that does not, the statement was not, this is the second time I have killed someone. It's not even, this is the second time I've shot someone. Certainly,
but in context, I mean, what else could it refer
in
to?
In context, Your Honor, I believe that it's certainly reasonable for someone to understand this means this is the second time I have discharged my weapon, maybe even the second time I have shot a suspect. But the jury was instructed not to speculate or engage in guesswork. And the juries follow instructions that the trial court gives them.
In light of that answer, what was the state of mind that you were attempting to prove? If this is the second time that I've discharged my weapon, draw a line to the state of mind that you would be intending to prove. That you've given two answers, and I'm not sure how they line up with each other.
Your Honor, I think the best answer that I can give is that the state of mind goes to intentionality. This is my second one, which is not.
Okay, this is the second time I've discharged my weapon. And how does that relate to the crime that was being charged or that would be charged?
And Your Honor, I think the best answer I can give you is that at that point, the goal of the prosecution was to prove this wasn't an intentional act. And that statement is something that happens right after the shooting occurred. And the statement was not that this was an accident, this was a mistake, this was a statement that it has happened again. And I think that when we look at the requirement for relevance, it does shed light on the state of mind. It does not prove the state of mind. Certainly it doesn't prove the state of mind. But does it shed some light on the state of mind? And it's our position that it does shed light on the state of mind. And with regard to the probative and the prejudice balancing, you know, we say probative versus prejudice, and that's really shorthand because this court's cases, including Profit, indicate that the test is the probative value outweighed by unduly or unfair prejudice? Because certainly all evidence that's introduced by one party against another is going to have some prejudice to it.
Have we ever held that our 403 analysis is a harmless error test?
I don't think the 403 and harmless error go together. I'm not sure that answers your question.
It does. 403, the prejudicial aspect, is it's already logically relevant, but there's some extraneous emotive quality to it that just doesn't seem fair. If you pass that test, there's no violation. There's no error at all. You don't have to ask yourself harmless error, but the arguments made before the 403, the second aspect of the 403 standard is really just the harmless error standard. I just don't know that. I've never seen that before.
I think harmless error is a separate analysis, Your Honor, and certainly
I think that goes to the default point.
I'm sorry?
I think that gets at the default point. That, you know, in other words, the second sentence of the assignment of error is the statement was unduly prejudicial, and so can that be made construed as preserving a challenge to the Court of Appeals ruling that the admission was harmless?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that it does, and here's why. Because the trial court has the responsibility of balancing the probative and the prejudice. And if the court got that wrong, you could still have harmful error.
I mean, the standards of harmless error and undue prejudice are not, I mean, they're not exactly coextensive.
No, Your Honor, they're not. And harmless error, and this, of course, would, if the court were to do the harmless error analysis here, would be the non-constitutional harmless error standard, and I will address that at this point. What we have in this case, as far as this court doing a harmless error analysis, is that the statement that was introduced was from the defendant's own taser camera recording. It was introduced, I think that Mr. Broccoletti indicated in his brief that the jury heard it a couple of times. It's hard to tell because of one of the exhibits has a lot of different things attached to it. But be that as it may, it's about 5 seconds worth of tape. Mr. Provo, who was the Walmart security agent, testified one time. He testified about this. He wasn't asked questions. He didn't elucidate on what happened. So this is a very small piece of evidence that came in, and I want to underscore, at a time when the Commonwealth was attempting to prove a charge of first-degree murder. And the other evidence in this case...
As far as the record goes, do we have any suggestion that that bit of evidence was seized upon by the prosecutor to make any points?
Your Honor, we don't have that because we don't have the closing arguments transcribed and before this court.
So am I right then from the page in the transcript where it enters the record until the final judgment, we don't have anything in our record where the prosecutor seized upon the point to try to drive it home?
We do not. What we do have, Your Honor, I do recall this, during the defendant's own testimony, those exhibits were played. 57, which actually has this tape in it, was played, I believe, one time during his testimony, but I believe his own lawyer introduced that. And then Exhibit 55, which had various things in it, was played a couple of times. But no, Mr. Provo did not.
So the defense counsel introduced the actual tape itself that included the audio.
No, the Commonwealth introduced these exhibits, but it was used by the defense during the defendant's testimony. And so if this court were to find...
Counsel,
yes,
on the issue of waiver, is there a nuanced difference in our Manchester Oaks analysis for an issue that this court would be required to consider anyway if we concluded that there was error? Is there...
I know that I did not find another case where the issue was or harmless error in a lower court was not assigned as error. But I don't think that it makes a difference, and even from the Manchester Oaks case, for this reason. What this court has said in a number of cases, recently and repeatedly, is that where the court below has articulated alternative bases, that the reason assignment of error must be made to each alternative basis is because otherwise if there is an independent basis out there, and it has to be an independent basis, but if there is an independent basis out there that's not the subject to assignment of error, if it's unchallenged, then there's this holding out here that's not before the court. And no matter what this court does, this holding is still out there.
But it seems to me harmless error would always be before this court if we concluded that the court erred.
It is true.
Whether it's raised or not. That's the problem that I'm having with the argument.
Yes, Your Honor. It's true that this court is required to do a harmless error analysis. But the Court of Appeals did its own harmless error analysis, and that's not before you. So if this court somehow did a different harmless error analysis or thought other factors were much more important for a harmless error analysis, it would be different than what the Court of Appeals had done. And that judgment remains out unchallenged before this court.
Isn't it the point that every time we've said we have a duty to address harmless error, it is we have a duty to address harmless error before we reverse a conviction? I don't think we've ever said we have a duty to sua sponte raise an argument for an appellant on harmless error to reverse a court of appeals determination that there was no harmless error. I mean, that's like four steps away from Manchester.
No, Your Honor, absolutely this court's harmless error analysis is where the court has found that there is an error.
Right, and the thought is we can't reverse something when a statute tells us we have a duty to not reverse anything if the error is harmless.
That is correct.
We have a holding from the Court of Appeals. The error is harmless and it's not been appealed.
That is correct. The Court of Appeals had two independent and separate bases for ruling on this issue and in affirming the trial court. And one of those bases is that there was not error. The other basis was even if there was error, it was harmless. And that second alternative holding from the Court of Appeals is not before this court because it was not included in the assignment of error that was presented to the court. We would urge this court on the procedural grounds, on the merits of our error argument, and on the, even in this court's own harmless error analysis, if that's where the court determines this case should go. We would urge this court to affirm the judgment of the court below, which is the Court of Appeals of Virginia, and also the Circuit Court of the City of Portsmouth. If there are no other questions, that is what the Commonwealth urges this court.
Mr. Broccoletti?
Your Honor, with respect to the Commonwealth's argument about the instructions that the jurors were given, the jurors are clearly told not to speculate or guess, but the jurors are also told to consider all of the evidence that, all of the evidence that's presented before them. Obviously,
why do we not have the closing arguments? In almost every case where harmless error is raised and the argument that it's not harmless, the direction to the court is look where it was, you know, seized upon. But we don't have that here. Why?
Well, because, Your Honor, there's enough indication that the tape was played and the statements were raised multiple times during the course of the trial. The jury actually came back during the course of the deliberations and had to view the tape again. And in that tape was the statement. So the statement itself is not just related to one segment or one part of the evidence, but multiple times throughout the course of the evidence, that statement.
But the closing arguments weren't transcribed.
Were no, Your Honor.
They were not ever recorded by the court reporter.
Correct.
So well, there was a statement of facts or anything like that saying the prosecutor relied upon the statement, used it to show state of mind on this issue or that issue or the other issue?
I don't think I'd suggest to the court that's not necessary to be able to argue this particular portion because it is before the jury. Just as the Attorney General argued that the jury can't disregard evidence that's presented before them. So we know they considered it. They're obligated to consider it. They're obligated to incorporate it into their deliberations. So there's no necessary, it's not necessary in our view to be able to print the closing arguments to be able to point out what factor the Commonwealth Attorney may have used with it. But, so the Attorney General argues that the jury is not to speculate, and clearly they're not to speculate, but what is the evidence for? Again, we come back to that ultimate question. What purpose is the evidence being offered for? How does it advance the ball? How is it probative of any fact? We argue to the court that it's not. With respect to the harmless error aspect of it, a number of this court's cases that we've talked about.
Why is it not relevant to the concept of second degree malice? That it's almost like a extreme recklessness. Okay, immediately after the event, the second time I've done this. Why can't a jury infer from that? Well, why would you say that first? And secondly, having said it right on the heels of doing this, what does it tell me about what you're thinking?
But you have to combine it with the statement that he made to Mr. Provo. Don't go far. You're my witness. This is my second one. The context of the statement is exculpatory, actually. If you think about it in that fashion, he's telling the witness, stay here. I need you. If he had told the witness, leave. This is my second one. Then there could be some nefarious purpose or something that's incorporated into that statement that you can consider as a result of malice. But it's not the context in which the statement is given.
Which is actually the very reason why I wanted to know about the closing argument, because if the lawyers were talking past each other in closing, or the prosecutor conceded, look, all it really tells you is second time, that's all we used it for, that would have just maneuvered the whole thing. It wouldn't be any argument left.
But the court never gave a cautionary instruction. We never requested one, because what cautionary instruction could we possibly request? Am I going to say, give a 404B cautionary instruction where I'm conceding that it's other bad crimes or it's a bad act? I'm not going to do that. The Commonwealth never proposed a cautionary instruction. The court never proposed a cautionary instruction because how do you limit it to the jury? What are you telling the jury to consider it for? Nobody knew. That's the whole point. The Commonwealth's attorney took one facet or one point at the time that it argued to the trial court. The Court of Appeals took a second. But with respect to the harmless error, this court has to make a determination under the Rogers decision from the Court of Appeals that the court first has to determine whether a harmless error could have affected the verdict, whether or not there was a curative instruction given. There was no curative instruction. Secondly, harmless error can also be in terms of sentencing. And that's the ZEK law, Z-E-K-T-A-W, decision of this court from 2009. How do we know that the introduction of this statement didn't have some impact upon the jury's determination when they determined the 2.5-year sentence was the appropriate sentence?
But that's the first time we've mentioned that in the Supreme Court of Virginia. There's
Sir?
No argument, there's no assignment of error, there's no reasoning that you've mentioned on the collateral impact on sentencing of the harmfulness of the alleged error.
Well, that's in our brief that we have argued that we do not know that the introduction of this evidence did not affect the sentencing. We've raised that issue in our brief and mentioned that in our brief. I thank the court for its
attention. Mr. Broccoletti, before you sit down, educate me for a moment. In Portsmouth, is there a recording device that is operated by the court as opposed to a court reporter?
No, it's a stenographer, Your Honor.
All right. And in this case, was the court reporter stenographically taking it down? So there is a record of it, but it just wasn't transcribed?
That's correct.
So there is a record of it?
Correct.
The closing argument?
Correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Call the next case.